Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 19th, 2006. Our session today is titled, I Am Gentle and Humble of Heart. Our presenter is Mike Blair. Session number BLMS 2006-3. Let's listen in.
Joining this afternoon's session, we're going to continue to reflect on some various I Am stories and statements of Jesus. And today we'll use, particularly look from the story of Jesus' statement, I am gentle and humble of heart. It's a little different than some of the other I am statements we've looked at from the Gospel of John. I am the light of the world, or tomorrow we'll visit, I am the bread of life. But this particular statement, I think, gives a window into, it was a connection I see very strongly with stories of Francis of Assisi. So I'm Mike Blair, and glad to be here this week as part of a teaching staff at Holden. And part of my interest, particularly, is in the arena of storytelling. And so today we'll share some stories. You'll have a chance to share some stories in pairs as well. In the our setup, our configuration is just a little bit different here in the Village Center, but we can, I think, make this work as well. So I'll begin just by reading this text from Matthew 11, at the end of that 11th chapter. It's a text that is familiar and used in a variety of occasions. Occasionally, it's used as a funeral text, but it's always been a favorite. So listen to this and consider the pictures that come to your mind as you hear these words of Jesus. Come to me, all you who are weary and carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. I'll read that once more. Come to me, all who are weary and are carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Let me ask, what are some of the pictures or images that come to your mind when you hear those words?
Well, it was the first part. I right away thought of my husband that passed away a year ago, that was having some health problems that were making his life not like he wanted it
okay.
to be.
So that was... Come to me, all who are carrying heavy burdens. Those burdens can be many different things, and certainly if we have health issues, that's a heavy burden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you.
And it was kind of the same for me. I was thinking about my sister, who was 11 weeks in the hospital this winter, and has just had a really tough time. It's really coming along,
yeah.
But it's nice. That was nice. It's reassuring.
It's a verse that can speak to us in many occasions, and I think it's part of the reason that's often read at funerals, or it's also, I think, not only at funerals, but it's often just a significant verse for pastoral care. There are a variety of verses that I find that are helpful, or that are a word for not only for others to hear, but even for myself. And if I'm serving as a pastor with someone in a difficult time, That's one that always kind of helps me keep things in a different perspective. I think of it as a verse, as a corrective. If I feel like I'm carrying too many burdens, or carrying burdens, or feeling then I'll read this and try to imagine things a little bit differently. Since we're going to visit the stories of St. Francis a bit today, I'll share with you first a legend from Italian folklore. And in Italian folklore, they have a great love for the character of Peter in Scripture. Peter, who's the bold one, who blurts out and says something. You know, he's the one, but he also, and often he's right on the mark, You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And he says, makes a bold proclamation of faith. And other times, you know, he tries to correct Jesus. And Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. And so he steps out of the boat. Now his name is Peter. You know, in the story of the walking on water from Matthew, Peter's the one who steps out of the boat. And so he has this boldness of faith. But then also, now there's a little bit of irony in that story. You know what has a Greek name, Petros. What does that mean?
Rock.
So somewhere it occurs to him, wait, Peter, Petros, rock, gravity, sink, storm. He's going down. And he thinks to himself, you know, this would be a good time to panic. And he does. And so there's a human element to Peter makes him, I think, accessible in many ways, but he's particularly revered in Italian folklore with a variety of legends, and this is one of them that relates to this text of carrying heavy burdens. One day, Jesus gathered the disciples and told them that he had a lesson for them, a teaching for them to offer, but he wanted them to gather before they traveled, before they walked to where he would give them an instruction at noontime to find a stone or a rock that represented the burdens that they were carrying at the time, the worries that were on their mind for the day, and they would carry those until noon. Now, the disciples they had many different circumstances in their life. Some had deep concerns about loved ones and all manner of things, the kinds of things that worry us, whether it's their household or economics or health. And some of them picked up large rocks and were carrying big burdens. But now Peter was looking around, and he thought, well, if we're going to carry this until noon, I don't want to carry a big rock. He's smarter. He's ahead of the curve. And so he thought, he found just a manageable rock that he could put in his pocket. And they walked, and most of the disciples were huffing and puffing. Some of them had big rocks on their shoulders, and they were huffing and puffing through the morning. And finally, at noonday, Jesus brought them into a shaded place where they could stop and cool. And Peter was there first, and he had broken sweat in the morning, and enjoying the hike. And the others were coming, tagging along, and finally put their big rocks down. And Jesus said, come and gather. He said, come to me, all you who are weary, and I will give you rest. And Jesus offered a blessing. And when he offered this blessing and he said a grace, the stones they were carrying turned to bread. Oh, and it smelled of fresh baked bread. It was miraculous. And the disciples, well, they were so surprised. And many of them began to feast on this bread, this wonderful bread they had, and they were eating their fill. And Peter was over on the side with his little taste of bread. Well, Jesus taught them about laying their burdens down, and he gave them instruction, and his words were also like bread, and they were renewed and fed that day. Well, the next day in the morning, Jesus told the disciples again, now once again, find a rock that represents the burdens that you carry this day. And we'll stop at noon. And so the disciples were looking around. Now Peter, he's thinking, okay, I'm taking a honking rock today. I'm going to find the biggest rock I can carry because I can't wait till lunchtime. And the other disciples, now they're feeling very different in this day. They're feeling a sense of a transformation, really. That they've literally let go of the burdens that they were carrying. And when Jesus spoke before about his burden was light, they're beginning to understand something of that. They've left these things in God's hands, and they know that they'll be cared for. So they're picking up small pebbles and putting them in their pocket, and they're walking. And all the disciples, well, when Jesus stops at noon, everyone is there, and they're feeling rested, and Peter's huffing and puffing and coming up the hill. Oh, my goodness. And finally, he gets there, and he puts his rock is so big, he puts it down, and he sits on it. And he's wiping his brow. He says, come on, say your prayer, Jesus. Turn this rock into bread. Let's go. And Jesus, he talks to them about living in community. And he preaches about blessed are those who open their hearts to God and trust in others. And he says, today, he says, we're going to learn of hospitality. And we're going to go into town and receive lunch at the hands of others. And the disciples, they were excited and anxious to learn about the ways of hospitality and to learn more from Jesus. And they all began to walk into town. And Peter just sat there for a while on his big rock. That's the story of Peter and the rock. There's a variety of stories like that in Italian folklore that they have, and part of it is, and it's, and we see in Peter perhaps a little bit of the fool in all of us, and as well as we see someone who has the capacity to make a great statement of faith. Well, in the stories of this, in the stories of St. Francis, I think of St. Francis in part of what's Jesus' statement, "I am gentle and humble in heart," because perhaps that's one of the first descriptions one would think of if you learn about the life of St. Francis. Now, St. Francis, I had an opportunity last year to travel to Assisi and to take a course on traveling in the footsteps of Francis, to travel to towns and some of the places where he made his pilgrimage. And it was really a remarkable opportunity. And I was moved, I guess, by the depth of the stories. I was moved by the also by the influence of Francis. Now, in the Basilica of the Basilica of St. Francis, the Basilica de Francesco in Assisi, a huge church that is, and it's ironic that here's someone who committed his life to poverty and prayer, and now there are massive basilicas, these cathedrals that are built around, not only around Italy, but around the world. But he also sparked a movement. How many of you do you have Franciscan hospitals, schools, and retreat centers? Consider the various ways that and you might find in all manner of places. What I've been surprised since I've come back is all the different places I find statues of St. Francis that have always been there, but I haven't noticed. And with the character of St. Francis, it can be easy to sentimentalize St. Francis. And, well, he's an easy saint to love. He loves the animals. He's kind of a religious Dr. Doolittle. He talks to the animals. And that's one of the legends that I'll share with you today. But what was radical about St. Francis was that he walked in the steps of Jesus. He lived in a time in the late 12th century when he was born. The church was more an arena of power and wealth. And the theology of the day was that God was distant. They had lost a sense of the incarnation. And Francis helped spark a movement to recover that. And he did that by listening to the gospel and responding very radically. He was born the son of a wealthy nobleman, a cloth merchant, who traveled around Europe and got the finest clothes and finest cloths. And St. Francis, as a young man, enjoyed a life of great privilege. And he was basically, he and his brothers were walking billboards or advertisement for his father's cloth business. So he would wear the finest clothes and that were available. And so when he had a conversion experience and was moved by the commission or the charge to sell all you have and give it to the poor, Francis, in the public square, in the piazza, in Assisi, the piazzas or plazas are gathering spaces. And when he had opportunity to do this, I'll get a brief technical check here, but when he had opportunities for that, then he heard this word, and it spoke to him deeply. He didn't hear it as something, well, for somebody else. He literally went to the public square in front of his father and stripped naked, and gave up his finest clothes, and the bishop there gave him a woolen rag that he would wear, and that would be his clothes for the rest of his life. And it was a dramatic and a difficult parting for him and his father. His father never made peace with that with Francis, but Francis is beloved in, not only in all of Italy but throughout Europe and even throughout the world. He's a saint recognized by many faith traditions. As a peacemaker, and in one of the frescoes in the or the paintings in the Basilica of St. Francis shows a picture of Mary holding the Christ child, and next to her is a beloved disciple, and on her left, but on her right, what is the favored side? If you're talking about who sits at the right hand of God, well, that's on the right side in this painting is Mary, and Mary is looking at the Christ child. It's a painting by Lorenzetti. She's looking at the Christ child as if to talk to him, and this is a very Italian painting, and her thumb is going like this, pointing to St. Francis, saying, like, he's a you boy. and with the beloved disciple to the side. So there's a sense in Italian folklore and in Italian art even that Francis is one of the most revered followers of Jesus. And all the places and shrines of Francis are patterned really around the life of Jesus. Mount Laverna is a place where he experienced, where they say, received the stigmata, where is this place of the passion. And Greccio is a village where he helped restore the idea of a living nativity. And then Gubbio is a place where he journeys to the wilderness. And so there are many places that mirror or pattern, and Mount Sebastio has a reminiscent of the Sermon on the Mount, where the city of Assisi is. Well, there's much I could say about Francis, but it's today I want to give you a little background, just by way of this, these notes that I'm sharing, and particularly get to the story of the Wolf of Gubbio. But one other note about Francis's life that I think speaks to us especially. Sure, should I get the mic a little closer and that'll help with sound? This building is a little different, so let me get this a little closer. That'd be better. Okay, that'll help with the recording too. Very good. Thank you for the reminder. There were four pilgrimages in Francis's life, and one of the things we learned from his life is the difference between pilgrimage and tourists. As our pilgrims and tourists. Now, in America, in our culture, and Western culture in general, we're very accustomed to the idea of being tourists. When we travel, we can be in control of things. We have the opportunity to stay. We pay for what we want, and we typically have don't experience, or if we do experience vulnerability or a lack of control, usually that's a problematic thing. We have customer service we call, or 800 number, Visa's where you want to be, or we can call American Express, anything like that. But the idea of a pilgrimage is a path, is the experience of hospitality. It depends on the gifts of others. It's an experience of vulnerability. It's often marked by gifts and surprises. And it also, though, is a path of simplicity and abundance. Now, we come to Holden for a variety of reasons and all kinds of things, but Holden, by the nature of the trip you have to make to get here, it becomes a pilgrimage. It becomes a pilgrimage. You end up with a company of people, we're traveling on the ferry, and you can kind of begin to spot and kind of tell, well, who's going to Holden? Can't you? You begin to sniff that out and begin to develop a community around this idea of a pilgrimage. Francis had four great pilgrimages in his life there were many, but four significant ones. He counted three of them utter failures. First, he left home to become a knight. Well, he didn't get far from home because when he was traveling, he had a dream. And the dream came to him and said, who is greater to serve, the master or the servant? Which is greater to serve, the master or the servant? Well, Francis took this to mean that even if he served a great and noble king, the king was still a servant of God the Creator, of God the Almighty. And so Francis turned from his journey to be a knight. He also made another journey to Santiago de Compostela, this great religious pilgrimage road in Spain that didn't develop, or for some reason that trip didn't happen. It's still a very revered pilgrimage site in Europe, but at that time it was the most holy of Christian sites or pilgrimages in all of Europe. He also made a journey to the Holy Land as a peacemaker. He felt God was calling him to make a peace in the Crusades. And so he went both to Egypt and to Palestine to visit both Muslim and Christian leaders. And he crossed enemy lines. He crossed lines of war. And he took great risk to his life. But he was not able to broker a peace. And he took that as a great failure for himself. He won the respect of many. And he also, though, found he was shocked and saddened by the many abuses of war that he saw during his journey. But that pilgrimage left him with bitter disappointment. Perhaps a pilgrimage that if he counted one as a success, would be the trip to Greccio, where he went to celebrate Christmas, but recovered the idea of Christmas being a celebration of the birth of Christ rather than a lavish party for the wealthy and for the rich. And that's a whole nother story, but I want to tell you the story of the Wolf of Gubbio, because to me that story captures the heart of St. Francis. It captures... And it captures also the many themes about the many themes from this text of I am gentle and humble in heart. In the northern hills of Italy, there is a small village named Greccio. At the base of a mountain, with a tall mountain looming above, and out to the valley, a deep dark forest. But Greccio is a beautiful village. And the people of Greccio were very proud and invested a great deal of money in their piazzas and their public squares and their gardens and fountains and the churches, all for the glory of Gubbio, because Gubbio, it was a beautiful city, and the people of Gubbio took great pride. One evening, the people of Gubbio were being ready to go to sleep, and the night had fallen, a shadow came to Gubbio from the forest. And that night, a shadow overtook someone in an alley. In the morning, people found a man there, dead and lying. His clothes were torn and his body ravaged. They didn't know what had caused this. But there was great fear. There were some young men who were brave hunters, and they said, "Well, we'll stay out this night. We'll find what happened." Well, the shadow came again, and the shadow found the young men before they found the shadow, and both of them suffered the same terrible fate. And in the morning, when they were found, there was screaming, there were cries. The town was terrorized. Someone had seen a shadow, and they said, "There's a wolf stalking our city." They held a meeting, and there was some bowmen who were skilled hunters, and they thought, "Well, we will find this wolf." And one of them in particular set up a hiding place where he thought for sure the shadow would not find him. And in that night, he suffered the same fate. And he awoke and they found the man. He never even drew a bow, never even had an opportunity to shoot an arrow. And so as it turned out, they had a big meeting and they said, "What will we do about this?" They had a town meeting and they met together, and someone spoke up and said, "I've heard there's a holy man in a town nearby. And perhaps he would help us because someone told me that he talks to animals." They thought, "What do we have to lose?" So they sent a delegation to see this holy man. They went to their nearby city, and when they got there, they were directed to this small little piazza, not the grand place or public square they were expecting, and they found this humble man dressed in poor woolen rags. And they asked him if he was the holy man that they were seeking, and he said, "Yes, that would be me." He said, "Do you talk to animals?" And he said, "Yes, sometimes I do." They said, "Well, come and talk to our wolf." And so he asked him, "Well, what would you have me say to your wolf?" And somebody piped up and said, "Well, tell him to obey the commandments. Thou shalt not kill." And someone else said, no, tell him to obey the great commandments, to love your neighbor as yourself." And someone else said, "Well, wolves don't obey commandments. A wolf is a wolf. A wolf will always be a wolf." They said, "Rather than that, tell him to go to Rome. The people of Rome deserve a wolf. We don't deserve a wolf. There are corrupt people in Rome. Or send him to Venice. There are dishonest bankers in Venice. Send him there. Or send him to Florence where they have carnival and they have no morals and no shame. Send a wolf there. Tell the wolf to go to another city. We Gubbianos are good people. We do not deserve a wolf." Francis listened to them for a while, and he said, "I will come and talk to your wolf." So they went back, and the next day, this simple holy man, he had made the journey, and he came to the edge of the forest with nothing but himself and his woolen rags, no weapons, and he journeyed deep into the heart of the forest. And he walked until finally he came to a sense he was in the presence of a shadow. And he stayed there for a long time, the holy man and the wolf. And finally he spoke, and he said only two words. He said, "Brother Wolf." And then he left. He came out of the forest. Now the villagers were waiting for him to come back, and some were thinking that, well, he would never even survive this trip into the forest after what the wolf had done in their town. And he was unarmed. Well, he came back, and as it turned out, the people said, "What did you say to our wolf?" And he didn't tell them what he said to the wolf, but he said only this instruction. He said, "People of Gubbio, you must feed your wolf." Bless you. He said, "You must feed your wolf." And then he left. And they looked at each other and said, "What does he mean that we would feed our wolf? What is this?" And they answered to one another, and they thought about this. And someone else said, "Well, what does it mean, our wolf? Since when did we get a wolf?" And finally they agreed, though, that they would take turns feeding the wolf. What else could they do? And that night, well, as it became dark and the shadow found its way into town, someone just opened their door a crack and put out a plate of food. And when they put out the plate of food, they closed their door quickly. And in the morning when they awoke, the food was gone.
and no one had been harmed. And so the next night, another household did this, and this went on. This went on, and the people found that if they fed the wolf would not terrorize them and didn't threaten them. Well, it happened, as it does with all God's creatures. The wolf grew old and eventually died. When this happened, to their surprise, the people of Gubbio were deeply saddened, and they wept for their wolf, and they wondered, now how will we feed our wolf? As for that holy man, his name is Francis, and he's from a city of Assisi. And there are many other stories of when he talked to the animals, but those are other tales to tell. But that is the story of Francis and the Wolf of Gubbio. Let me just ask you a bit for some reflection on that story. There are many stories of Francis, but let me ask you some of the, are there pictures in your mind from that story or images that, that kind of come to life as you hear these?
I never really see the wolf, you see the shadow.
Okay, so for the wolf you see just in the way that especially that's kind of shadowy character is described at the beginning. Yeah, you see the shadow more than the sense of a vision of a wolf. And even when Francis encounters the wolf, it's only as a shadow in the darkness. Yeah.
Could be the shadow of anything or anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to open the door and feed someone, people that...
Sure, because once they when they start to feed the wolf, there's no mention of seeing the wolf. It's a very, very Jungian story to come to terms with your shadow, and you think about that. I mean, this is Jung was very much in psychology all about archetypes and images, you know, kind of primal images that are formative for us. And so the wolf certainly in stories is one, but the shadow, the whole idea of coming to terms with the shadow, that's a very powerful image in that story. Are there any other images or pictures?
I liked his question when he said, well, what do you want me to tell the wolf?
Sure.
You know, you can just see him kind of standing there gently, and the other people are frantic, and it would seem obvious to, you know, what they wanted him to do.
Sure, sure. Tell the wolf, just make him go away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do anything to make the wolf kind of solve the problem. Okay. Okay. So there's this connection. You think of, several years ago. This was more than several years ago now. But when there was a big effort to, a lot of press about cleaning up New York, you know, and kind of hustling out the homeless. Making it more tourist friendly, that as they were doing this with there's a sense that, well, let's just get rid of this problem, let's get rid of this the problem of the homeless or the problem of street people, and here in this story there's a clear sense that what Francis offers is a relationship, a kinship, and that's a big part of of the spirituality of Francis. What is, you know, his poem to the hymn to the sun and the moon, what is that called? Brother, son, sister, moon. So again, this deep relationships of kinship. Deep relationships of kinship. Yes.
I was struck by how the people of good faith and goodwill responded to conflict initially with doctrinal positions and theological statements.
They yes.
Need and the pain of their enemy.
Yes, and think of it, that See, in this story, and this is where I find this story to be a profound story for about peacemaking. Because in the initial attempts also, what do the men have to offer? Now, the other thing about Gubbio, if you visit there, it's a very Italian macho town. There's all kinds of hunting shops. There's all kinds of it's a place where and they have this great race in the spring there where they carry these huge boxes up the mountain to this to the St. Ubaldo Church, and it's this so there's a great deal of machismo in the it's kind of in the ethos of the place, and so Francis, you know, after the hunters have failed, and they've kind of tried an approach of strength and weaponry that has failed, and then they turn to their religion and they turn to the doctrine, to the theology. Well, we have a we're, and you get the picture of the town as all being completely respectable, and that there is no room for a shadow, as was noted before, that we don't have a shadow. Hey, denial is a great tool, and it's very effective. I mean, I can use it. We can all use it. And so any of you, if you think of the writer Ursula Le Guin, she has a story called "Those Who Walk Away from Omelas." And in that short story, she tells a story of a town where everything is perfect, but in order to live in that town, you have to agree to you have to have knowledge of a child who is locked in the basement of the city hall and is neglected, and you have to have knowledge of that and agree to ignore it. And that's the price of living in this utterly perfect village, and the story is about those who walk away from that town. Well, this is a similar theme going on here with this village that is so proud of itself. And so part of St. Francis, Francis, what he offers here with this, what if you think of this image of Francis journeying into the forest, dark into the forest, or of encountering the shadow, how might that translate to a spiritual journey or a pilgrimage or quest? What might that represent coming to terms to for ourselves? You've hinted at that. Facing your fears, coming to terms with your fears. Psalm 23, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Yes. So there's ways that this echoes so many different things. with the themes in this, one thing that strikes me about that particularly as a vision of, and in the context of the place of Gubbio, and for Francis as a young man who at one time trained to be a knight. And so, but when he founded his order, part of the rules of the order that no one at any time would carry any weaponry. This would be an order of peace. And even when they traveled through dangerous areas, that was part of the marks of that order. To be a Franciscan, you would carry no weapons. It's part of the reason the people to this day have a deep love for not only for Francis but for the order. And they also knew that when they traveled, that they would be received with hospitality because they would never be a threat to anyone. They would always be safe to be received. So they lived and abided by this hospitality. What I also see in this story is a connection. There's some parallels to Jesus' journey to the wilderness. It doesn't exactly parallel. He doesn't encounter like a figure of, you know, in the same way of Satan and facing temptations, but the notion of going off to where the wild beasts are, as it's noted in Mark, but also helping the people come with a different vision. They learn to befriend the wolf, and at the end, when the wolf dies, you know, they're not relieved, but they feel a loss. They feel a loss. So they've gone through this process of integration. They have now, instead of denying that the shadow is no part of their community, they've learned to love that. They've learned to tend it. They've learned to care for it. And that says something about our own spiritual journey. That says something. I'll just read a portion from some of our sessions, or a portion from a book that by Joan Chittister that speaks to the spiritual task of life. And she speaks of despair, which would be another way of thinking of the shadow that we have to contend with. She writes, "The spiritual task of life is to feed the hope that comes out of despair. Hope is not something to be found outside of us. It lies in the spiritual life that we cultivate within. The whole purpose of wrestling with God is to be transformed into the self we are meant to become. to step out of the confines of our false securities and allow our creating God to go on creating in us. In this pilgrimage, in this story of Francis, you see a story of someone who's willing and open and vulnerable to the possibility of being recreated or being renewed, and invites a whole community into that as well. I want to invite you just to turn to, as we've talked a little bit about this, if there maybe is something from this story that strikes you, but to turn with a neighbor and just to share briefly, is there a pilgrimage story or a story, or is there something out of this story that just that either connects with you, that that maybe that resonates in some way? Or if you simply, like I said, if you like to share a story, a brief story of a time when you noticed a trip changing from something that felt like a tourist trip, where it became a pilgrimage, where it was more of a spiritual journey. So share either a reflection on this story or something about a spiritual journey of your own. And just turn briefly and talk with a neighbor. We'll take a few minutes for that and then come back and share another Francis story. I hope these are stories, these kind of maybe spark some stories that you have to tell when you return from Holden, when you return to home or wherever you're heading after this, if it's the next leg of the journey. And one of the things on a quest, on a pilgrimage, part of that is that that oftentimes the place or the destination that we consider to be the prize or the origin or the destination ends up being really a marking point along the way. Do you remember the subtitle of J.R. Tolkien's book, The Hobbit? Anybody know what that?
There and back again.
There and back again. So the "and back again" part is really important. And even in The Wizard of Oz, when Dorothy, where's she traveling to? And she needs to get to Oz, but is that her final destination? And where does she end up at? Well, there's no place like home. And does she have some great treasure when she gets home? What does she have to offer when she gets home? What does she have to tell? A story, her story, indeed. She has quite a story to tell. And that is what, in Old English, they would call the boon of a quest. The boon is what is life-giving. What helps make you whole, what feeds your soul. And it's the opposite of bane, of something that drains you, or something that is a burden, something that is that wears you down. And so part of in quest stories, it's always the heroine or the hero is trying to navigate their way to find what the boon is, and then try to avoid the risk of returning with a bane or returning empty, returning. But in a pilgrimage, what you have at the end, you don't come back with a thing. If Parsifal is looking for the Holy Grail, well, Parsifal maybe never finds the Holy Grail. Parsifal finds a remarkable story. And in your Holden trips or other pilgrimages, they're always the dimension of that is transforming is the story that you have to tell. I'll just read a brief passage from a storyteller, Robert Bella Wilhelm, that speaks to that. He says, there's a difference between silently thinking aloud about our story and telling our story aloud. Our stories are fully grasped by us only when we are simultaneously the teller and the listener. And so we bring the boon back home to our community and ourselves. What have we discovered about life, about ourselves, and about God are the only genuine treasures worth bringing back home. All the rest are trinkets. Isn't that a great line? I mean, it's fun to gather souvenirs. It's fun to have pictures and all of that. The sweatshirts, you name it, the t-shirts. But what do we learn more deeply? How do we enter into that deeper journey? That's what I find in the story of Francis. I'll share another story of Francis. The story of Francis in the Sermon on Mount Subasio. Mount Subasio is the hill that the mountain that Assisi, the city of Assisi, is on. It's about halfway up. Have any of you had opportunity to travel to Assisi? Some of you have. Yes. Oh, what a beautiful city! Oh, what a beautiful city! And so this is the Sermon on Mount Subasio. Arising behind Assisi is Mount Subasio, an open grassland atop the rounded mountain is dotted with small farms and villages, and the soil is thin, and it's difficult land to farm. The winds are fierce there, and the farmers and shepherds who live on top of Subasio are very poor. Over 800 years ago, when St. Francis was returning home from Tuscany to Assisi for the last time before his death, he had to cross over Mount Subasio, and now he was too weak to walk, and he was being escorted. He was too weak to mount a horse by himself, and so the knights of Assisi took it as their duty to take turns carrying him home to die. The knights had gone to bring Francis home, but these men were more than a welcoming party. Many of them were also armed and ready to fight in case anyone from Perugia, their foes from Perugia, should attempt to take Francis. And the reason that they would try to kidnap him was so that if he would die in Perugia, well, that would be the resting place for a saint, for everyone knew that Francis would be declared a saint shortly after his death. There was no doubt about that. And whatever city he died in, it would become the place of pilgrimage. So the knights traveled to protect him. Because everyone knew that he was a living saint, the knights traveled with him, and they took longer and the more arduous way. They went across the top of Mount Subasio rather than going through the familiar routes, and they were burying their living relic dressed in rags. For half a day, Francis would sit in front of one knight, and for the rest of the day, someone else would carry him the rest of the way, and friars walked alongside, keeping to his request that they be humble and walk. The Franciscans walked everywhere. They walked the pilgrim path rather than ride. And so it went on for days. And these knights had known, many of them had known them from Francis from childhood. They were not strangers. Some of them had partied and reveled with him in his younger and wilder days. They'd gone to school with him. They had caroused with him. They had gone through training as knights. They courted and did all sorts of things together. But now they rode across these windswept dirts on the top of Subasio, and they shared the same silent thoughts. Many of them had become remarkably successful in the ways of the world, had gathered wealth and power. They were noble knights of armor, proud riders on expensive steeds, owners of large landholdings. They led successful lives, and yet all of them were troubled by the same question. Each one knew that Francis was simply God's little poor man, the poverello, who owned nothing, not even the ragged clothes that he wore. He would have been just like them, he thought. But something had changed Francis. And these men had a hard time admitting it to one another, but each longed for such a change in himself. And yet they were each afraid of the possibility. They were bringing Francis home for the glory of Assisi, but and also because they loved him. But deep in their hearts, they also wished to be like him and to even more learn from him. The Assisi knights were bringing him home across these mountains with dotted small farms, surrounded by farmers and poor shepherds, and they were hungry and tired. And they stopped at a farmhouse. Francis rested there, and he sent the friars out across the landscape to beg from farmhouse and shepherds to collect a few crumbs of bread for their meal. And they returned to share their meals with Francis. But the knights saw this, and they thought, well, we can go and get a meal. And they went out with bags full of gold and money, and they went to each farmhouse and to the shepherds and said, we will gladly pay you whatever you would charge, for we need a meal, and we're traveling, but we can pay with our gold. But the people were suspicious of their wealth and their power, and they said, it has been a hard year, and we have very little. We don't have nothing to sell. And so the knights came back empty-handed, and they asked Francis about this, and they were disappointed. And they told him what happened, and Francis said, you have received nothing because you have depended only on your money, and you think your wealth will buy you anything. Now go back to the house where you flaunted your coins arrogantly and go simply, beg for food in the name of God. For our Lord himself said when he was on this mountain, blessed are the poor, for God's reign is yours. My brother, this mountain called Subasio is yours. Go and live the gospel. Having heard this sermon on Mount Subasio, the knights repented and humbled themselves. They removed their armor and their cloaks and fancy hats. Some even removed their boots. And the proud men set out into the night, going from door to door again. Atop Mount Subasio, they walked only with the stars and the moon and the heavens of the lights to guide them. And the poor answered their door, and they were surprised to find the same men coming back looking very differently. They bowed their heads and lowered their voices, and in their hands they held no gold coins but an empty hat, an empty saddlebag, or an outstretched arms. and these proud city rich begged for food from the country poor in the name of Jesus. In just a short while, the knights returned. They returned to Francis at the farmhouse, and they brought him not only bread, but also cheese and olives, dried fruits and nuts. One knight was even given a wineskin filled with strong red wine, and Francis smiled and said, "Now you have emptied yourself, not only of your wealth, but of your pride. Blessed are the poor, for God's kingdom is yours." Now, Francis had grown blind in his final year, and he could not see that the knights had returned in the company of the farmers and the shepherds and their families. But then he heard the voices of children, and he laughed. And so the friars and the knights and all the people atop Mount Subasio, they shared their bread, their poverty, and God's abundant blessings with one another. And that night there was no wind that howled across the cold mountain. The air was still, the sky was clear, and they shared a feast under the bright stars of heaven. That's the story of the Sermon on Mount Subasio. A Franciscan rendering, perhaps, of the Sermon on the Mount. And let me ask, for those of you who have been to Assisi, what is kind of a character or spirit you remember about the place?
Well, I was just telling him, I didn't know if it was self-imposed or my imagination, but I felt such a sense of gentleness and peace when I was there.
Yeah, the City of Peace is what it's called, and I think that there is a quality, there's a dimension of it that there is in the lower area that's a little more touristy and modern, but in the old Assisi, it is remarkable. It's hard to describe, but it has, in the same way when you go back and you'll tell people, especially if this is your first time to Holden, it's just really hard to describe that place, the character or the spirit of the place. And there is something remarkable about Assisi. Is that it is a place of pilgrimage. It is a place, and it's also ironic, though, that it's a place because people come. I mean, the Italian culture, the food, everything. If you go and try to have just a light meal, well, you're doomed. I mean, I was trying to explain. Yeah, if you try, say, I'd like, you know, just ensalada. That's all. You know, that we did this. We were, you know, because. The meals are all great, and it's very reasonable. And we just wanted a light lunch, and they kept bringing things out, and they were translating more or less. It's on the house. Don't worry, we don't want you to leave hungry. And so it was a lot of fun. But this sense of abundance is, and a deep sense of the spirit of Francis that is even more the spirit of Christ is what makes, I think, that endure and what makes that. There are many, many remarkable stories. There's also, a whole cycle of legends and stories about St. Clare, who was a contemporary of Francis. And she founded an order, the little sister of the Poor Sisters of Clare. And one thing interesting about Francis, I think vocationally, that I really appreciated in hearing his story, Christ came to him in a vision when he was praying and said, "Rebuild my church." He was a young man at the time. Well, and he also was perhaps a little bit of a literalist, because you know what he did when he heard this vision to rebuild my church? He became a stonemason. And he rebuilt, the churches were in bad repair, and he rebuilt three churches. But then he got to thinking and did the math, this is going to take a long time. And he also then began to understand that call to be something deeper, that it wasn't the buildings that needed rebuilding and tending, but to recover a spirit of prayer, to recover a spirit of discipleship and walking in the footsteps of Christ. And that became the gift and the contribution of Francis. And that's where, to me, that whole vision of pilgrimage really marks his life, and the whole notion when you just have a chance to visit some of the places, and that he walked everywhere. And it's no wonder that, he died relatively young, in his 40s. And I wonder if he just didn't run himself ragged. It's hard to say. But what he squeezed out of those years and what he gained out of those years was remarkable. I'm going to share, let me just ask if there's questions, comments, reflections.
Before we get too far away from that story, can you read that part from Matthew again?
Sure.
Because it's the same story. It's identical. I mean, what Jesus says in Matthew is identical to the story that you read in.
Right. Okay, very good. I'll read that Matthew passage again. Okay, this is from Matthew 11, and it echoes very much with, particularly with both stories, but come to me, all you who are weary and carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light.
And I hear that and I just see those, I see those knights shedding the wealth, shedding the gold,
yeah,
shedding the armor, shedding their shoes, and what they get back, is to be fed. They get fellowship, they get the children, mm-hmm, you know, to St. Francis, because you said they wanted something from him, which wasn't just to have him in the town, but they could see that somewhere he had taken a different road, and it wasn't, you know, I mean, they were the power of the world. And they saw this man, and that's what they wanted, and he couldn't have it in that armor, you know. I mean, his poor guy's, you know, it's just so wonderful.
Yes, that connects very well. The notion they're longing for a conversion, and in order to be open to that, they have to make themselves vulnerable.
Yeah. That's the cool thing.
That is the, and that's a theme that runs through many of the stories of Francis, of people learning to let themselves be vulnerable, letting themselves be open, and. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It wasn't even a village, into their family, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the same story.
Yeah, because it's such a powerful gospel story and it is, you know, echoes in many ways. That's a thank you for that. Well, let me just close then with just one other pilgrimage metaphor, pilgrimage offering. This is a poem by Mary Oliver called When Death Comes. And I'll just read this and let it be our closing. And I'd be glad to stay around for kind of reflections or conversation if you would like that. But this will be our closing offering. And it's a poem that is a call to a pilgrimage as well. When death comes, like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut. When death comes like the measles pox, or when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades. I want to step through that door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I consider eternity another possibility. I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy and as singular. And each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending as all music does toward silence. And each body a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say all my life, I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened and full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited the world. Thank you for joining our pilgrimage this afternoon.